Prophecy TV.
Well, we like to talk about Isaiah 45, don't we? Isaiah 45, 7, that God is the maker of good and creator of evil. That is a great passage of scripture. We use it all the time, as well we should, to prove that God is sovereign, that he has everything under control, even the evil things, that is, things that break. There's no moral tinge to the word evil, ra, in the Hebrew. It doesn't mean like iniquitous. It has nothing to do with sin. It has to do with breaking things as opposed to building things. So God's the author of building things and breaking things. Of course, he's got to break a lot of things to build new things. That's what he does. I kill, I make alive. That's God speaking. Oh yeah, the killing, the death is necessary. And the sin is necessary, of course. And all these destructions that surround us are necessary for the contrast of when we see when God builds, when God makes things anew. All things are new. That's a great verse. We love it. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Behold, I make all things new. Oh, that's wonderful. That's angel wings. But he can't make all things new unless all those things were old, unless all those things were decrepit and terrible. Just like yesterday, I contrasted temporary with aeonian. Yeah. So, necessary contrast. Oh, by the way, this is Martin Zender. Happy to be with you every day, 5 days a week here anyway on MZTV. Thank you for your love and support of this work. I appreciate you. Like, I can't even express it. I'm pretty decent with words. I can go on and on and on, but words fail me when it comes to the appreciation and the love I have for you, because I wouldn't be doing this were it not for you. That's not a cliche. It's just the truth. I know you're out there. When I'm talking, I'm looking at my kitchen stove right now. But in a very real sense, I'm looking at you. Many of you I've met. Those who I haven't met, I'm still looking at you. We're connected. This isn't live, but it feels live to me. And I love this. I absolutely love it. So we're all in this together. So what I want to do is look at the context of Isaiah 45. The context, of course, starts in chapter 44. God is talking about a certain person. And while he's talking about this certain person, it triggers him to talk about how he created good and evil. Because this certain person that is the topic of Isaiah 44, 45 is not an Israelite. It's not a king of Israel. In fact, it's a worldly man who doesn't even know God, who in fact worshipped false gods. And this man, his name was Cyrus. Cyrus was the king of the world. No, not Leonardo DiCaprio at the bow of the Titanic with Kate Winslet, although no doubt he felt like the king of the world. Cyrus was the actual king of the world. Successor of Nebuchadnezzar, predecessor of Alexander the Great. He was a king in Babylon, Babylon being the capital city of three world empires, the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, and the Grecian Empire. The Medo-Persian Empire, that was the empire over which Cyrus ruled. Medes by themselves are fine. Persians by themselves, not a problem. But when you put Medes and Persians together, watch out, somebody's going to take over the world. And that's what happened, the Medo-Persian Empire. And God is talking about Cyrus. And you're going to see how remarkable this is when I begin to read from the Concordant Version of the Old Testament in Isaiah, starting chapter 44, verse 28. God, quote, who is saying as to Cyrus, this is a quote, I'm quoting from Scripture, who is saying as to Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and all my desire he shall perform. wait a minute, this guy is a heathen king. Never mind. Okay. Who is saying to Cyrus, he is my shepherd, all my desire he shall perform, so as to say of Jerusalem, it shall be rebuilt, and the temple, it shall be founded. Because at the time, Israel, namely the house of Judah, specifically the house of Judah, headquartered in Jerusalem, had been taken in captivity to Babylon by that bad boy, Nebuchadnezzar. But here's the thing. People reading this prophecy, contemporaries of Isaiah, to whom this letter came, they're reading verse 28. Of course, there's no verse 28 at the time. What they're reading, it says, who is saying as to Cyrus, he is my shepherd. And look at each other and they say, who the hell is Cyrus? So Martin, how can they not know who Cyrus is? You just said he's the king of the world, most famous man on the planet. How can they not know? Because when this prophecy was written, the dude had not even been born yet. Ooh, let alone taken over the world, let alone succeeded the Babylonian Empire headed by Nebuchadnezzar. That's right. God names an individual who does not yet exist. Damn, that would be handy if he did that in the Greek scriptures as to the man of lawlessness. And then Frank Smith shall stand in the Holy of Holies saying that he is God. Frank Smith. That would be so nice. Then we'd watch out for Frank Smith. He's the Antichrist. We know because he's named in the scriptures. And that would have been written 2,000 years before Frank Smith was born. But it's just as remarkable now that I think about it, because Paul's still talking about the Antichrist who will exist, even though he isn't now on the stage. God could have easily named him. God knows his name. God knows the name of the man of lawlessness. Knows it. Could have thrown it out there just like he did here. But he's really showing off here. You know, but prophecy isn't that difficult. Telling the future isn't that difficult when you've already written the future. It doesn't even rise to the level of a parlor trick when you already know the future. So the guy doesn't even exist yet. This is really great. It reminds me of Romans 9, when Jacob and Esau, not as yet being born or putting anything into practice, either good or evil. In this case, Paul, writing in Romans 9, is writing subsequent to the existence, obviously, of Jacob and Esau, but not having been born. That's my point here. Not having been born or putting anything into practice, good or evil, God made a decision. So God has not only already made a decision of what this guy will do, and I'll tell you what he did here, but he's naming the guy before his mama even named him, and it's before his daddy even named him. So they didn't know this, but they had no choice than to name him Cyrus, the guy who would take over the world. They had no choice. I could just hear the conversation. What should we name him? What should we name him, Harold? I think we should name him Joe. I don't know, Harold. I think we should name him Billy Bob. Oh, I think we should name him Kenneth. Sounds like a noble name. Guess what name they decided on? Just randomly. Cyrus. Woo! What do you know? Cyrus was the one. He was a decent guy. Even though he worshipped false gods, he didn't know the true God, but the true God knew him. And as I read Isaiah 44 and 45, the true God directed his entire life, made him do what he did, operated in him to will and to work for the sake of God's delight. No, he wasn't in the body of Christ. No, he wasn't an Israelite. He wasn't a believer. But still, God operated in him just like he does in us, as described by Paul in Philippians 2, 12 and 13, to will and to work for the sake of his delight. That's what God's going to get into here. He's the one that published the edict that Israel would return to the land. Israel could go back to Jerusalem and build a temple. After 70 years in exile, that was enough. They went back to Jerusalem because of Cyrus. What this shows is God's control of not only good people, but people who worship false gods. God's in control of them too. No wonder he's inspired to say in 45:7 of this same prophecy, I, the maker of good, creator of evil, I do all these things. I'm the one who directs David. I'm the one who directs Cyrus. I direct Jacob. I direct Esau. I direct Hitler. I direct the Apostle Paul. So now that you know a little bit of the backstory here. Oh, and they found, they excavated what's called the Cyrus Cylinder. Oh, I got to tell you about that before the show's over. There's evidence, there's written evidence. This is so great. There's written evidence, written on stone, of the existence of this man and what he did. Let me go back. Isaiah 44:28, who is saying as to Cyrus, he is my shepherd. My shepherd. Yeah, and all my desire he shall perform. So as to say, of Jerusalem it shall be rebuilt, and the temple it shall be founded. And that's just what the guy did. Isaiah 45 now, the chapters didn't exist in the original letter that Isaiah wrote. Thus says Yahweh to his anointed. He's calling Cyrus, a heathen king, his anointed. Anointed doesn't necessarily have to refer to Christ. It's anyone who's set apart by God for an important job, an important task. It could be Cyrus. It could be Jesus Christ. Thus says, it could be David. Thus says Yahweh to his anointed, to Cyrus, who's, there he is, naming the guy again, whose right hand I hold fast. Wow. Do you think Cyrus felt God holding his right hand? No. To hold sway over nations before him. I shall ungird the wastes of kings to open before him double doors. In other words, God's going to make this guy's path to the throne smooth. He's going to get rid of all opposition. Cyrus, while he was coming to power, looked like a genius. This guy's a genius. Nobody can oppose him. No, it's just that God ungirded the wastes of other kings, and God opened before Cyrus double doors, and gates shall not be closed. I myself shall go before you. What's going to stop this guy now? Absolutely nothing. And I shall level mountains. That's what he was going to do for Cyrus. I'm going to level mountains for you, dude. I shall break down doors of bronze and hack down bars of iron. I give you treasures of darkness and buried goods of concealment, that you may know that I, Yahweh, calling you by your name, am the Elohim of Israel. Did the guy ever come to realize that? Maybe he did. That you may know that I, Yahweh, calling you by your name and the Elohim of Israel. Maybe he won't realize it till the great white throne. Maybe something happened in his life where he did end up realizing it. Not sure about that. Calling you by your name. Imagine this guy getting a copy of Isaiah. Somebody hands it to him. But after all, you know, he was in charge of a bunch of Israelites. They were living in Babylon at the time. Somebody says, hey, you might be interested in this. What do you got? I got a letter from one of our prophets. It actually names you. Oh, that's interesting. Let me see that. He looks at the thing. Oh, I'll be darned. Sure does. You know what's weird, King Cyrus? No, tell me. What's weird? This was written 70 years ago. But I wasn't. Yeah, you weren't born 70 years ago. That would surely tell Cyrus that I, Yahweh, calling you by your name, am the Elohim of Israel. On account of my servant Jacob and Israel, my chosen, I am calling you by your name. There it is again. Whoo, that's impressive. I am entitling you, yet you do not know me. See, there's a time where he did not know him, obviously. But I think the time came where he did know him. I am entitling you, yet you do not know me. That could be said of every single person on the entire earth. God is entitling them, even atheists. God is entitling them. God is breaking down doors for them. God is giving them their breath, giving them their heartbeat, and yet they don't know him. God named them before they were even born, and yet I don't believe in God. It's stupid. I can't imagine a more profound stupidity than being an atheist. And I hope to offend every atheist out there. Now, I am Yahweh, there is no other. Here it comes, winding up to the statement we all know and love. But now we have the backstory. I am Yahweh, there is no other. Except for me, there is no Elohim. I am forearming you. I'm giving you all the tools you need to take over the world over Nebuchadnezzar. I am forearming you, yet you do not know me, that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west, there is no one apart from me. I am Yahweh, there is no other. Former of light, creator of darkness, maker of good, creator of evil, I, Yahweh, make all these things. Don't we love this verse? This verse is an anchor for us. It is a proof of the sovereignty of God. And how do we know this is true? We have to have faith that it's true. We trust that it's true. How do we know that Cyrus is true? Because this is in the same context of Cyrus, this king of the Medo-Persian Empire, which had sway over the entire earth. In the same context is where we read of God, maker of good, creator of evil, the God who does all these things. I now direct your attention to the Cyrus cylinder. This is helpful to your faith. This man is an historical personage. He existed. And there was an amazing artifact excavated near modern-day Iraq, which is Babylon, with Cyrus's name on it. In fact, it's an edict. It's a decree from Cyrus himself. The Cyrus cylinder is an ancient clay cylinder now broken into several pieces on which is written a declaration in Akkadian cuneiform script in the name of Persia's Achaemenid King Cyrus the Great. I'm going to show you a picture of this thing. It looks like a corn cob. Yeah, looks like a corn cob on the 4th of July. It's not. It's the Cyrus cylinder. It dates from the 6th century B.C. and was discovered in the ruins of the ancient Mesopotamian city of Babylon, now in modern Iraq, in 1879. That's when it was discovered. That's when it was dug up. It is currently in the possession of the British Museum, which sponsored the expedition that discovered the cylinder. It was created and used as a foundation deposit following the Persian conquest of Babylon in 539 BC when the Neo-Babylonian Empire was invaded by Cyrus and incorporated into his Persian Empire. I want to let you know what this thing says. The text on the cylinder praises Cyrus, sets out his genealogy, and portrays him as a king from a line of kings. The Babylonian king Nabonidus, who was defeated and deposed by Cyrus, is denounced as an impious opposer of the people of Babylonia, and his low-born origins are implicitly contrasted to Cyrus's kingly heritage. So he's really running this Nabonidus down, this Nabonidus guy, the Babylonian king Nabonidus, defeated and deposed by Cyrus. The victorious Cyrus is portrayed as having been chosen by the chief Babylonian god Marduk. I told you this guy was worshiping false gods. He thought he was put in power by this false god named Marduk. Everything I have, I credit to Marduk. You moron. It all came to you from God. He's the one that broke down the double doors for you, sir, to restore peace and order to the Babylonians. The text states that Cyrus was welcomed by the people of Babylon as their new ruler and entered the city in peace. This cylinder appeals to Marduk, the freaking false god, to protect and help Cyrus and his son Cambyses. See, even though he didn't know him, God was holding his right hand. Here's the thing. The cylinder's text has traditionally been seen by biblical scholars as corroborative evidence of Cyrus's policy of the repatriation of the Jewish people following their Babylonian captivity, an act that the book of Ezra attributes to Cyrus. Yeah, because that's what he did. As the text refers to the restoration of cult sanctuaries and repatriation of deported peoples. So that this dude's thing was to restore people's religions. He was all for religious freedom. Yeah, this guy was pretty good that way. Even cult sanctuaries. Yeah, leave them go. Let them worship their cults. What about these Israelite people? They say they want to go back home to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple. Ah, yeah, I'm giving permission here. Here's an edict from me, the king of the world, for them to go do just that. And so, wow. My main point is for you to see that the scriptural testimony is true. In the same context, this is so marvelous on so many levels. In Isaiah 44 and 45, we have mention of a king by name who did not exist yet. And then we have evidence at the British Museum. This was on loan, this Cyrus cylinder was on loan for a while to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. We have archaeological evidence that this man existed. And so the biblical account, what do you know, is true. And in the same context where this historical personage is named, God declares that there's no other Elohim besides him. That's a truth that can't be excavated. If it could be, it would be. It can't be excavated, but it's just as true as the existence of this king. That the God who has called us into sonship and put us on nearly on the par with his son, with the same privileges as his son. His son will always be first, but we have the same privileges as his son. This God, who's our God, announces himself as the only capital G God in the universe, who does all things, both good and evil, for the ultimate good of everyone. That truth can't be excavated, but it's just as real as a solid rock in your heart, in your mind, and in your spirit.